Good morning, everyone. Welcome to December. It's December 1st already. This is the ADK Homeroom. I am your host, Frank. Welcome to your home away from homeroom. This is certainly my home away from homeroom. I have been exiled from the classroom, of course, due to the mask mandates, even though I am fully vaccinated, even though I have a waiver under the Americans with Disabilities Act that my own school asked me to obtain. I'm still exiled from the classroom. Hopefully everyone will return to their senses soon. But you know who's not returning to their senses here in the North Country? Well, it's someone down in Keysville. We had an honest-to-goodness bank robbery down here in the North Country. And we're talking like broad daylight, walk into the bank, stick them up, give me your money. But it came with a distinct North Country flavor, of course, down in Keysville at the Mountain Valley Federal Credit Union. The suspect in question took an Uber to rob the bank. Yeah, and his getaway car was also an Uber. So needless to say, he's been caught. Oh, everything's good in Christmas time up here. We've got tons of snow on the ground up here in the mountains. It's a white winter wonderland out there. What a great place here. Even if people do come to their senses and I get back into the classroom, we'll still maintain the ADK homeroom here, because where else could we talk about and reach a global audience even? Not saying that my audience is huge by any means, but we do have India, Germany, Italy, the UK, all kinds of countries. It's fun to see those things pop up on the Podbean map of the world. So we'll still maintain this, because where else could we have conversations like we're going to have today about how to put kids first in a lesson? Here's what happened. Yesterday, someone was saying that educational researchers, that's in quotes, educational researchers, are going to put out a book on teaching kids quantum mechanics and general relativity. This person was rightly skeptical, and I agreed. I called shenanigans on that. Absolutely. Teaching kids, specifically talking about like middle school age kids, and teaching them quantum mechanics and general relativity, big time shenanigans there. First of all, as a general rule, anybody in education who's honest and paying attention will tell you that from educational researchers, in scare quotes again, nothing good comes. Nothing good comes from educational research. I mean, I'm sure there might be one or two good things, maybe, but on the whole, right, educational research gave us whole language back in the 1990s. Remember whole language when they didn't teach kids how to spell? And then educational research has also given us the horrific math curriculum that is still in American schools, which is the worst, well, one of the worst things about American education right now is the completely inefficient approach to all kinds of education, especially in math. And the real consistent problem with educational researchers is that they constantly put education first, or they put their topic first. In this case, physics. They would put physics first, or they would put education first in there. You can just tell from talking to them and from reading their books, they're all about that physics. They're all about the education. And you're saying, well, hold on here, Frank. Shouldn't they be putting education first? I mean, they're educational researchers. Well, they should be putting the kids first, right? If you're really going to be working in this field, you need to always have kids first and foremost in your lessons, in your mind, in your research. You need to be thinking about kids. You don't need to be thinking about some abstract scheme of epistemology, some abstract epistemic structure that you're going to try to put into place. You need to put kids first and proceed from the point of view of the child. And then after I pointed that out, Then somebody else said, "Really? Okay, Mr. Big Shot, why don't you tell me how to do that then? You're saying that everybody puts physics first or puts education first. Why don't you tell me what it means to put kids first?" "Okay, I will. I will." So the thing is, though, it's Poetry Wednesday. Poetry Wednesday here on the podcast. So we do need to have poetry. I couldn't get through a week without my poetry. Oh, where's my fainting couch? So we're going to do this with a poem, not with physics, but you can do it with physics, certainly, or with chemistry, or with really anything. You'll see, I think, that the method, the sample lesson I'm going to give you for how to put kids first works with anything. And then there are many, 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 many different ways to put kids first and to have that show up in your classroom. So maybe on Friday this week, maybe next week we will do a lesson, a sample lesson, and talk about how to do a physics lesson where kids are clearly front and center in your lesson. But for today, it's going to be poetry. And of course, after that, we will get to the news. If you come back around 24, 25 minutes, and we will be back on to the news. All right, so how do you do this kid-centered lesson? Well, the first thing is you do have to have a good lesson, right? So all the normal lesson planning stuff has to be there. I will get to the magic kid-centered stuff first, but if we're going to do this, we're going to do it right. So the normal lesson planning stuff does have to be there. You start with your goal. And, what do you want the kids to get out of this? Obviously, kid-centered, you got to put the kids in your goal. So what do you want the kids to get out of this? And for our demo lesson today, that's going to be twofold. Number one, you want the kids to appreciate a poem. And number two, you want the kids to see how analysis can deepen their appreciation of a poem. Now, you could have different goals, right? I'm just picking out like the start of a poetry unit here, picking out the lesson at the start of a poetry unit, just to get the kids excited and to get them to see the value in what you're going to do throughout the unit. So, number one goal, get kids to appreciate a poem. And number two goal, get them to see how analysis can deepen their appreciation of the poem. Notice how, even from the start, we're putting kids first, we're putting them right in the goals from their points of view. Second thing to think about is your kids, your audience, your clients, your customers. Now, technically, your clients, your customers are the parents, but the parents are focused on their kids, as you should be. And the learning outcomes that the parents are going to be looking for are certainly centered around the students too. So you have to know your students. You need to know, right? You've got maybe 20 kids, 25 kids. Which ones like WWE SmackDown? Which ones like the Winx Saga? Which ones are just over the moon about Zendaya and Tom Holland getting together, right? So you pick a poem that's appropriate to one of those things. And you go through your cycle. Are you catering today to the dominant personalities in the class, to the left out personalities in the class, to the high end learners, to the middle end learners, to the low end learners? You can't just say that, oh, magic fairy dust, I'm going to do one lesson and the lesson is going to sprinkle to everyone evenly. No, you have to plan a lesson, and since you've got 25 different people in there, you can differentiate it after you go for your primary audience, but you have to know your primary audience, and then you can differentiate it after that. So you take turns, you go through your cycle, you don't focus on the same primary audience every single day, but for each lesson, you pick one group to be your primary audience. Now, this is a generic demo lesson. This is going out to interwebs, the whole global phenomenon, the terraforming for artificial intelligence project that we are undertaking here. And so I can't know every single one of y'all's preferences, and I'm just going to have to base it on the way the world is going. And I do know, obviously, high school students in general, middle school students in general, although this would be more of a high school lesson here that I'm going to do for you. And so, what are the things that you could think about in poetry, in a poem that will appear to the generic high school audience? Well, obviously, sex. Right, that's number one with a bullet. Kids are going to love anything or at least pay attention to anything like that. Next, female protagonists, right? Just look on Steam. Steam, if you're not aware, number one PC gaming platform. And well, I don't know if platform's the right word. Distribution service, perhaps we should say. Sales outlet, perhaps we should say. And Steam has its own tag, right, for female protagonist games. Or just go to the YA or the NA section. I don't think they label their sections NA for near adult, but go to the YA section of your FLBS, your favorite local bookstore. You'll see in like that section, almost every single book has a female protagonist, right? So let's think about that. We'll think about sex. We'll think about love. We'll think about female protagonist as we consider our audience. By the way, standard disclaimer: if I read another YA novel, fantasy YA NA novel about a young female assassin with mystical powers and mysterious bloodlines and two guys who both want her, I am going to hire that young female assassin to kill myself. All right, actually, not really. I kind of eat that stuff up just like everybody else these days. Kind of a sucker for that. Dusk, Dawn, Throne of Glass. But anyway, that's what you have, right? That's what you have. Female protagonist is huge. So we select our poem based on that. And so you think about it. You go through all the different poems that are out there. And the next criteria, right, is that when you're picking the right poem, you got your subjects out here, but your poet matters too. Your kids are going to be losing trust in you. Your students will lose trust in you if you pick a nobody. So that's just another way of showing that you have respect for the students. Don't pick your college professor's poem. Don't pick your friend's poem. Heaven forbid, don't pick one of your own poems, right? Show the kids that you're not wasting their time. You're going to get them a poem that has some relevance to the outside world, and it's not some insider's promotional club that you're trying to foist onto your students here. They know time is limited. If they see you pushing some non-important poem on them, they're going to resent your waste of their time. And I'm not saying small-time poets can't be important, but you need to start with the big names, or at least the medium names. So, what poem do we choose here? Some good choices, right? Richard Wilbur's Playboy, right, is very much on the sex topic, but not so much on the female protagonist topic. You could do May I Feel, Said He from E.E. Cummings, but I don't know, there's just not a whole lot there. The classic ones, To the Virgins to Make Much of Time, or The Vine from Herrick, almost anything from Herrick. But that's not really a female point of view. To His Coy Mistress, also not a female point of view. A.R. Ammons' Their Sex Life is hilarious, but not a female protagonist, and just not enough there. All the usual suspects. So to it's kind of rare actually to get a female protagonist. And so we come to the holy city of, not Yeats, no, Millay, of course, Vincent, I'm gonna say Vincent Millay. And the best choice here is her sonnet, I Being Born a Woman and Distressed. It checks all our boxes. Kids like it, it's fun, it's about sex. There's a female protagonist, it's by an important writer. And yeah, if you don't think Millay is important, then come fight me after the podcast, or now. Bring it like the wide wind that assails the blossom. So, goal number one is accomplished. We picked the right poem, and I've demoed so far. Not this is not the magic here, but I've demoed so far at putting kids first with your goal, choosing a poem according to the kids' criteria, not according to your criteria. You still want kids to learn and to meet your instructional goals, of course, but there are many ways to do that, and you should use a way that is centered on the kids to do that. All right, and then after that, you just don't have to screw it up. The bell rings, put the kids literally first. What does it look like, right? If I walk into your classroom, what's going on here to see you putting the kids literally first? Well, you never start a class by talking about anything except the kids. Right, you talk to the kids individually, get everybody listening. How did your day go? Have you heard my favorite new joke? Right, what's my favorite time of day? I don't know, I like a lot of them, but I kind of think, thought about it at 6:30, hands down. Tell them your favorite joke, ask them their favorite joke. Talk to them, your new shirt. Oh, that would be perfect for next season of Outer Banks. Ah, except nobody on that show wears shirts. What's going on? This is crazy. And you have to dress well yourself, obviously. Clothes are the beginning of manners. They are your most personal machine. It's impossible to be polite if you're dressed like an insult. All of the standard advice, and of course use sales techniques. So that's it. That's it. That's what the start of class looks like on this demo lesson. This is not the magic yet, but this is just the laying the groundwork, showing everybody that you do put kids first. So you talk to them first when they come into the classroom about the kids. Don't talk about anything else except the kids for the first minute or two of the class time. You dress like Aubrey Graham if Jimmy had grown up to be Snake instead of Drake, and always be closing, right? Sales techniques are super important. Now, here we go. Let's get to the magic here, the actual lesson. How do you do it? So you want to talk about poetry. There are many ways to put kids first in a lesson. We're going to do the Chinese fire drill. And yes, I said Chinese fire drill. And yes, we could update the name for the woke crowd, but on the other hand, we could also tell the woke crowd to go fuck itself. So, first thing you do is you say, "All right, guys, we're doing this poem. It's an awesome poem. It's by Vincent Millay. I'm going to let you guys figure out what it's about. I don't want to talk about it too much more. So, everybody read it on your phone. Go." And you put the title on the board so they can find it. They don't just have to listen it to you. So, yeah, their phone, I said it, use their phone. Don't use your handout. Use their phone. Again, come at it from their world, their point of view. Show respect. You respect them. Use their phone. And of course, you're going to use their phone. I can't stand it when teachers don't use their phone. Imagine if somebody came here from the year 1950 and you told them, "Hey, we have these amazing devices now." And they have the entire world's knowledge on them and the ability to talk to people who create this knowledge and further this knowledge. And this device fits in our pockets. And the person from 1950 would say, "That's amazing." And you'd say, "Yeah, oh, but of course we don't use it in school." And the person from 1950 would say, "What? What? You don't use it in school? That's crazy." Yes, it is crazy. So use the phones. So they read the poem on their phone, right? And then you hand out a page that has all the topics you want to cover. For purposes of this class, maybe you want to say like four things, like the theme, how to find the theme, how the structure supports the theme, diction. Maybe in this poem, you've got words like propinquity and zest and possessed. And then finally, the structure in particular, like the Petrarchan structure of the sonnet, the meter, and the rhyme scheme. So maybe some things like that. So you put down questions on the piece of paper, and here comes the magic now. Two different copies. You put down, if you want to do it on one page, you can, and then just do like the 10 things you want them to learn on the top and the 10 things you want them to learn identically placed on the bottom with space for their responses or their answers. And you want to do a few short factual questions like, what is the rhyme scheme? And you leave a blank there. And what does propinquity mean? And you leave a blank there. But then you also want to do slightly more than half fun, open-ended questions like in this poem, what do you think the word frenzy means near the bottom, right? And of course it means the sex act itself. But you leave it open-ended, right? Don't make it multiple choice. And then you say something like, do you think of this the theme of this poem is, and here you can do something like multiple choice, despair, the nature of art, romantic love, female sexuality. And you put down what you think the theme of this poem is, right? And then the key is that you've got the same questions at the top of the page and at the bottom of the page with like a dotted line in between so you can tear it off in the Chinese fire drill. Or you could do it on two separate pages if you want to use more paper. That's totally fine because and you leave the blanks, the backs of them blank for the kids who forgot their paper. They can keep their notes on the back of the page, right? And in addition to, a couple fact-based questions like, what does possessed mean? Or give me three different meanings of the word zest. Then, in addition to questions like that, you've got your short answer questions what is distressing the speaker in line one? And then you also want to throw in a couple questions. Bear with me here, like my eyes are blank. And my middle name is blank. And you're probably like, what? What does that have to do with this? Hold on. You will see. Okay, and then you want to do a final question. Final question, like two parts. A, rate this poem, and B, list a bunch of celebrities from your kids that your kids love and say, check off which celebrity would most relate to this poem. Or you can put down relationships. Kids absolutely adore, relationships and celebrities, and you can say which celebrity relationship is most represented by this poem, and make that a checkbox off, right? And then you tell everybody, all right, you've got your phone, you've got the poem, do as much as you can on this, look it up, use your second brain, which is the internet, use your second brain and fill out the top questions. Do not, by any stretch, by any means, fill in anything in the second copy. Just do the first copy, okay? So you give them 10 minutes to do that. And then you say, all right, now here's what's going to happen. You are going to tear off the top part and leave the bottom part on your desk with your name on it, or leave the blank second page, whatever one is blank. Make sure your name is on that blank page with all the answers and put it on your desk. And then the Chinese fire drill starts, and everybody rotates one seat to their left. And they sit down, and at that seat, they fill in the first blank question with their best guess about what the student who sits in that seat normally answered for that first question. So if the first question was, what does propinquity mean? Then in the Chinese fire drill, the kid who sits in that desk writes down what they think the student who normally sits in that seat would have guessed propinquity means. Would they have found the right answer? Then write down the right answer. But if you think that they wrote down something else, or they think that it means something else, you write that down. Right? When you get to the question, what does frenzy mean? Write down what you think that person's interpretation of the word frenzy was. When you get to the question, like I said to put in two fun questions, like my eyes are blank. No staring. They all try to look at the other person across the room. They all try to think, oh, Susie sits here. Let me look at, Susie. Show me your eyes. What's your middle name? No, you can't talk to the other person. You can't look. You can't do anything like that. They have to guess. They have to guess. And then you sound the bell. Only give them like 15 seconds. 15 seconds to sit down and fill out that answer. Do not give them a lot of time. I do like 10 seconds once they get used to this, right? Sit down, because they've already done these questions once. You gave them 5 minutes to figure out what the answers to these questions are with their second brain. They know the questions. They don't need any more time. So they sit down and fill out the answer. Then you sound the fire alarm again, and they go to the next seat, and they answer the next question about how that kid in that seat would have answered it. Their guess for how that kid in that seat would have answered it. And then you do that again, and you rotate all the way through. So if you have 10 different questions on your page, you rotate seats 10 different times. Each time the student answers the question at the desk she or he is sitting at, as if she were that student there, her best guess. So if the question is, what is my middle name? She just guesses, oh, I think the person whose seat I'm at, his middle name is probably Horatio. So she writes down Horatio, right? Or if you think, oh, the person here, I think that the three different meanings for the word zest that he found, I don't think he has any clue looking things up etymologically. I think he's just going to go with like zest the laundry cleaner, and he's going to go with the zest the extra energy, and then he's going to put down I don't know what, like a seasoning. Maybe he'll get it confused with yeast. And so you put those things down, whatever their best guess is. And then after you're out of questions, you say, all right, go back to your original seats. And they love it. They adore it. And now they're sitting back in their original seats, and they look at all these answers that people put down about poetry, but through the student as a lens. Do you see the magic here? The magic is that now you can talk about poetry. You can talk about the subject material using the students as a lens. You go through the kids first, literally. because they're finding out each other's approach to the poem. They're going to look at the page and they're going to be like, why did you think I meant that? I would look at a poem like this. I would say this. And you give them, a minute or two to just, be loud and talk about and screech and how could you not know my eyes are blue? And how on earth do you think that I think Frenzy means the Harrison Ford movie? I clearly am aware of what Frenzy is referring to in this case. And then you proceed with your lesson, right? And then you say, okay, so there are a lot of different ways you could do it. But you say, here's one way you can do it. You say, all right, let's look at propinquity. How many, I'm going to tell you the answer to propinquity, right, is similar to proximity, but it has the extra twist of nothing propinks like propinquity, according to Ian Fleming in the James Bond film. And in the P.G. Woodhouse meaning, it always seems to have this extra flirtatious meaning on top of proximity, propinquity, something about the sound, propinquity, maybe the pinkness of it. It adds that extra, sexual or romantic piece to it. So how many people had an answer that was somewhat similar to that? How many people didn't? And you go through and then they say, well, someone wrote on my page this. Someone wrote on my page this. And you have your discussion that way. You talk about the poem based on the student's reaction to the poem. And people don't have to be embarrassed. People don't have to be hesitant or anything like that because the answers that are on their page might not be their own answers. They're much more willing to come forth sometimes with answers because they're like, how could somebody have written this down? And it can stay anonymous because they won't even know necessarily who wrote which answer on their page. You don't have to go in order. You can tell the kids that they can answer any question they want when they get to a page with the blank numbers so they can't count dice to see who answered which question. Another way to do it is you can say how many people matched the person sitting at your desk with your own answer. How many got that answer correct? And see which ones they are most likely to get correct and why they thought that those were correct. And as you do so, as you talk about the students and their answers to poetry, you will get what does it mean to be possessed? Is she talking about the devil? Is she not talking about some demonic spirit? Is she talking about being possessed like a woman is traditionally possession of a man before the 20th century, right? She wrote this poem only 5 years after people could vote. Did anybody get that? Did anybody put anything down about the 5 years after they vote, after women could vote? And you approach the concepts that you're trying to teach based on what the kids said about them. And that's it. That's the magic. That's the magic. By doing this Chinese fire drill type of lesson, you now have a student lens to look at the material with. And everything that you do about the poem or about the material will be cast in the light of the students. It will be focused on by the students themselves, right? It's like the poem, was it a Merwin poem? Everything I, your absence runs through me like a thread through the needle. Everything I do is stitched with its color, right? So now everything you do in the classroom is going to be stitched with the color of the students because they have given you the thread to put into the needle by their answers. And you just ask, and you can say who matched this. You can say who had this. You could also do it in reverse style. And you could say, all right, who got it wrong? Where did what answers were most likely to be wrong? And why were they most likely to be wrong? Right? It's absolutely fantastic technique. I strongly recommend it. And then you go on for homework, right? And remember, don't give any more than 5 minutes of homework for a lot of reasons. And you say, well, which, students, which interpretation of the poem did you like best and why? Whose interpretation? This person's, this person's, this person's. And you come in tomorrow and you see whose response has the most votes. And that's it. That's how you put kids front and center in a lesson about poetry. Rarely done, right? Because the teacher has to have full command over the subject. You never know which way it's going to go. You have to be on your toes and able to take the material in a zillion different directions. But That is the teacher's job, and you could do it. And I said, come back in 25 minutes, but it looks like we're at about 30 minutes. 30 minutes for our news. Let's get to some of the news that is out there. Oh, well, China, ProPublica published this great piece yesterday about China having spies in American university classrooms. Again, a big fat duh to this, but it does give some nice examples about how in Purdue, this one guy was just participating in practice Zoom sessions for a seminar about the Tiananmen Square massacre in 1989. And even though the seminar hadn't happened yet, just based on the practice session, all of a sudden, this student, his name is Zhao Kong, his family started getting threatened by the CCP back in China. His family called him in tears, sobbing, "You have to stop. You can't do this. They're threatening us. They're telling us all these horrific things that are going to happen to our family if you participate in the Zoom session." So yeah, ProPublica, good piece there. Nothing shocking if you've been following China, but a good concrete example of it. Next thing in the news, you got this Boise State professor. Oh my gosh, he made the news right yesterday. Scott Jenner. Don't know how I should be pronouncing that, but he participated in a conference that was the Idaho Conservatism Conference, or the it was the National Conservatism Conference in Orlando in late October. And he said, basically, you know, straight out of 1905 piece, he said that women used to have many children, even though the odds of dying in childbirth were actually very high, and now it's so sad that they shouldn't. And he wrote, "Young men must be respectable and responsible to inspire young women to be secure with feminine goals of homemaking and having children. Every effort must be made not to recruit women into engineering." Wow. That is some old school statement there. Obviously, that's ridiculous. But the interesting thing is going to be how tenure holds up here. Hard to see him staying on at Boise State. But on the other hand, that's what tenure is for. So we will see. We will see. But that is about as big a throwback attitude as I have seen. And he doubled down. He's put on Twitter something like, "Our independent women are more medicated, meddlesome, and quarrelsome than women need to be." Wow. Wow. That's some caveman stuff right there, Professor Jenner. That reminds me of like Opus in Bloom County, right? When he's at the newspaper and he's like, "Penguin lust. I support penguin lust. It's great. All about penguin lust." And then some guy calls in and says something about, I think, nun beating. And Opus is like, "Good Lord, man, I can't support that." And yeah, Scott Jenner, holy cow, good Lord, man. Nobody can support that. At least, well, some people do. ISIS does. Next, Democratic Senator Jeanine Shaheen from New Hampshire warned the Supreme Court of the United States, SCOTUS, if you will, that there will be a revolution if they overturn Roe v. Wade. Now, they're not going to, all right? They're not going to. But warning the Supreme Court of a revolution, that's kind of similar to what Schumer did, right? Schumer, I think last summer, threatened the Supreme Court if they overturn Roe v. Wade, and Roberts had to issue some statement saying, "Hey, Senator, you know, you don't threaten the other branches of the government." So not a good look from the Democratic senator from New Hampshire right there. But I do not see Roe v. Wade getting overturned. Roberts and his court will find some way to weasel their way out of it. And they'll issue some ruling that is possibly interpreted as supporting conservative viewpoints, but they're not going to issue a sweeping ruling. They haven't on anything else so far. They might on the Second Amendment, but if it's taken them this much effort and time to get to the Second Amendment, they're not going to do it for Roe v. Wade. Next, leaked papers. This is from the BBC News. Leaked papers have finally been published in full. The New York Times had them like 2 years ago, but didn't release all of them. And now they have been released to the public. These papers that link Xi Jinping to the crackdown on the Uyghurs, and by crackdown I mean the concentration camps with the torture and the rape and the forced sterilization. This is terrible, what's going on with the Uyghurs, and it goes right to the top of the Chinese Communist Party. We know this, but the papers did just come out yesterday to the public in full, so you can go and read about them, right? Coerced labor, interesting. Deploying Uyghurs to pick cotton in Xinjiang. Wow, that has some historical overtones in the West. Interesting. And then, forcibly sterilizing Uyghur women. Just absolutely disgusting, horrific stuff. And the fact that the world is not outraged more is very telling that that is not what people are focused on. People always say, how could they let what ha the Holocaust happen in World War II? Well, how could we let what's going on with the Uyghurs happen right now? Next news item, Chris Cuomo fired. Well, I should say, suspended indefinitely for helping his brother out. The most interesting thing here is all those people who spent the last day and a half, 2 days saying, oh, Cuomo did nothing wrong. Cuomo, of course you're going to do it. That's your brother. And now they're dear, precious media company CNN is coming out and saying, actually, that's really, really, really wrong. But of course, they won't admit it. Of course, they won't go back and say, oh, actually, CNN knows journalism more than we do. I guess he did cross a journalistic ethics boundary here. No, all those people who were supporting Cuomo are still going to go on and support him because it's not about logic. It's not about consistency. It's just about tribalism. Next news item, credit where credit is due. Ryan Cooper at The Week is pointing out that Biden has really, really, really cut down on drone strikes compared to Obama and compared to Trump. In Yemen, which is a bit of a gimme just because of the way the fighting has gone there, but in Yemen, right, in 2017 you had 200 drone strikes, and in 2021 you are down about like five drone strikes. In Iraq and Syria, again, a little bit of a gimme just because of the way the war has gone there, but still, a Barack Obama in his last 4 years of his last term, he had like thousands, like 15, 16,000 drone strikes. Trump was almost at the same level, and then Biden basically none, at least so far. And again, Somalia, Trump had by far the most drone strikes in Somalia, over 200. And then Biden has had less than 20 so far. Of course, it hasn't been 4 years yet, but good steps in the right direction. Next news item, Brian Kelly leaving Notre Dame as their head football coach and going to Louisiana State for a contract that everybody is saying is 10 years and $95 million. That's the absolute minimum. It's really well over $100 million with everything else that's in there. So, on the one hand, congratulations to Brian Kelly, but on the other hand, the hypocrisy here is really leaving a bad taste in my mouth because these college coaches complain about their kids not playing in bowl games, right? Because kids don't want to get injured, they want to get drafted. And I shouldn't say kids, the young adults, they want to get drafted so they don't play in the lower tier bowl games. And then, okay, so fine, you complain about that, but then you bail on your team before the bowls have even started. I mean, there's a chance that Notre Dame could actually make the playoffs, which is the top four teams in college football. There's a chance Notre Dame could squeak in there, and he just bolted on them. So the hypocrisy of complaining about your own team is disgraceful, frankly. But Kelly's famous for going all purpley and yelling and embarrassing his players publicly, so I guess I shouldn't have expected anything more out of him. A couple more news items of note here. The power is back on in China. In September and October, remember they were having planned power outages. Terrible sign for the country. How are they dealing with it? They recognized it was a terrible sign, and now the power's back on. How? Well, they're burning tons more coal. Tons more coal. Reminder that the way to deal with that is not through a carbon tax. The way to deal with that is protecting property rights and establishing a system of air rights. And if somebody infringes on your air rights, they get punished. Punitive law, not preventative law, is the way forward. But also just a great example of China's disregard for its own statements, its own commitments to lowering coal emissions, just going right back on all those commitments and ramping up coal production again. Disregard for world air quality out of China. But again, that's what you expect too. They're putting out all kinds of ozone depleting chemicals and they won't admit to that either. Terrible, terrible from China right there. Really interesting data, penultimate news item here. Really interesting data out of France. If you didn't see this, the France ATIH, their technical agency for information on hospitalization. This is an official government agency here. They put it out, and COVID patients were 2% of all hospitalized patients during the year 2020. That doesn't really fit too well with the narrative of overwhelming the hospitals now, does it? 2% of total hospitalizations in France. And if you do it by days, 4% of total hospital days. And even if you really twist it and go to intensive care days occupied by COVID patients, even that number, the worst one possible, is only at 19%. Do we have data like that for the United States? I'm not sure if we do, but that total hospitalization days last year, 19% of critical ICU beds occupied by COVID patients last year. That's not a good piece of data for those who want renewed lockdowns. Remember, it all started with 2 weeks to save the hospitals, 2 weeks to prevent overflow in the hospitals, 2 weeks to flatten the curve and give us time to respond. Yeah, and then only 19%. Remember all those Navy ships in New York Harbor, all those beds on the Navy ship in New York Harbor that never got used even once. Perhaps we should slow down and think about what we're doing before we go all draconian and take away people's rights. Yeah, there used to be something called the Blackstone formulation. There still should be. That in this context means it's far better to err on the side of recognizing people's rights than to go trampling over people's rights and sort it out later. Very sad. That's going to do it for today's podcast, folks. I hope that you saw how the student-centered lesson can be put into practice. One of the many, many, many ways the student-centered lesson can be put into practice. I've used that method a gazillion times. Kids love it. They don't get to do stuff like that. They don't actually get to do lessons where the students come first in a lot of other classes. So, go and make yours the first. Actually look at the material through the lens of the students. I hope you enjoy it. Let me know how it goes. Subscribe. Find me on Twitter at ADK Homeroom. Find me in Substack. Take care.